COVID-19 crisis provided an opportunity for the world's most powerful institutions to restructure society and the economy, whether it be the Great Reset, vaccine passport programs, or the push for central bank digital currencies, the economy may become more centralized in a post-COVID world. But in order to understand the motives behind the central banks, for example, you must understand how they operate. But is it possible that everything we thought we knew about macroeconomics and monetary policy is not the full truth? I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and while much of the discussion surrounding COVID-19 has been based on medical ethics and the science behind the gene-based vaccines, many of the measures implemented to prevent the spread of COVID-19 have had a profound economic impact. This all comes at a time where over the past 50 years, the central banks have become more and more powerful. Is it possible that the central banks are using the COVID-19 crisis to advance their efforts to establish a central bank digital currency? Joining me today to discuss COVID-19 through an economics perspective and the role of the central banks is Professor Richard Verner. Professor Verner is a former investment banker and university professor in banking and finance. He holds a first-class honors degree in economics from the London School of Economics and a doctorate in economics from the University of Oxford. He is a founding chair of Local First, a community interest company establishing not-for-profit community banks. Professor Verner's book, Princes of the Yen, was a number one bestseller in Japan, and the documentary has more than 2 million views on YouTube. In 1995, he proposed a new monetary policy he called quantitative easing, a concept that has become very popular among the central bankers. Professor Richard Verner, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Let's begin by dismantling some of the common misconceptions surrounding the economy. The public discourse concerning monetary policy and macroeconomics has been controlled by the central bankers. So please explain for us, what is this central bank narrative that has become dominant in academia and in the media?
Well, the central bank narrative could probably be summarized by the following sequence of sort of tenets. Beliefs about how the economy works and about how things function and how policies work and what policies should be taken. Namely, the fundamental starting point is that markets should be left on their own as much as possible because they will be in equilibrium. Demand equals supply in equilibrium. And how do we get there? That demand equals supply, well, prices move to give us this equilibrium. So price is a key. Now, if you read the small print, then that actually is only true if a number of assumptions hold. So we are actually implicitly assuming these assumptions to be true, namely perfect information. Everyone knows everything. Nobody needs to watch this video, for example. Perfect competition, flexible prices that instantaneously adjust, complete markets for everything and their grandmother, rational agents that are selfish and only care about themselves but not about others, and also don't influence others and cannot be influenced by others. So any company with an advertising business model like Google, of course, would immediately go bankrupt and wouldn't exist today. And people are only focused on maximizing their own utility, their satisfaction, their consumption. Companies only focus on profit maximization, and people have infinite lives and so on. So you see, it's kind of a list of extremely implausible scenarios, but that's the foundation, because only then can we expect there will be equilibrium. So, but you know, that's the foundation starting point. And this equilibrium analysis, most of English language economics essentially has been equilibrium economics for the last 200 years. Then the interest rate becomes the important variable in the economy, because that's the overarching price. You know, in an equilibrium system, it's prices that are key, because they equilibrate demand and supply. And which price is the overall important price? Well, it's the price of money. And that's why central banks focus their work on, mostly, you know, they don't have to do much, is more or less the story, but they help a little bit by, stimulating the economy or slowing the economy. How do they do that? By moving interest rate. And here, the fundamental relationship is lower interest rates give us higher economic growth. And if you want to slow the economy, you raise interest rates and you get less economic growth. There's a few other components now of this overall narrative, such as the role of banks. The role of banks is not emphasized. In fact, they're completely left out of the analysis. Why? Well, they're just financial intermediaries. And they, you know, they're not powerful. They just collect deposits here, do some analysis, and then distribute the money there. So they're just like other financial players. That's why we don't need to focus on banks. And actually, let's move on. Nothing to see here. So banks are not focus of the analysis. The other important tenet is that governments should really not intervene very much, because markets are left best to their own devices, except, of course, the central bank. Now, the central bank should be very, very powerful and very independent from governments and from anyone, and not really accountable to anyone, because these are technocrats that do their very professional job and they're left best on their own devices, and they can then fine-tune the economy and everything will be fine. And so that's the wonderful world of the central planners' economics narrative, which has become the dominant narrative in the last half century and certainly in the last few decades. And also we've seen in the last 4 or 5 decades, central banks have become increasingly independent, more powerful. That has reinforced the story, because essentially if you want to make a career as an economist, that's the storyline you have to, the party line you have to toe. Otherwise, you'll find you'll get into trouble. There'll be various problems. So that's the official narrative. Now, we haven't said anything about whether it's true. And perhaps, you know, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
The central bank narrative has since collapsed. How have the central banks reacted to this?
I think it is fair enough to say that it has collapsed, because essentially it's become obvious to everyone that on all counts, this narrative, the storyline, does not hold. That's partly obvious when you look at the markets, and partly one needed very, very careful empirical research to demonstrate that. So, you know, this narrative about equilibrium has never been supported by any empirical evidence whatsoever. And then the concluding sort of relationship between interest rates and economic growth, which is that lower rates lead to higher growth, higher rates lead to lower growth. It's interesting that most people believe that because they've heard it so many times, and it's been reiterated by not just central bankers on a very high frequent basis, but by other economists, policymakers, think tanks, journalists, in the media, and then of course academic economists in lectures and textbooks, in their writings. It's repeated so many times, it's uncountable, you know, stated in uncountable ways and numbers. And therefore, it seems most people think, well, it must be true, because surely, you know, since it's so often restated, it will have been tested hundreds of times, thousands of times, 10,000 of times, maybe over the past 5 decades. But when I looked at this, it became apparent that actually there weren't any empirical tests of this whatsoever. And so I conducted empirical work on this. Most recently, a very, very careful study, because, you know, it is sort of controversial to tackle the underlying belief that is common to all the mainstream macroeconomic schools of thought in the last 200 years, and even alternative schools of thought often have this as a central tenet. So it was a very careful study published in the journal Ecological Economics 2018, Reconsidering Monetary Policy. And I simply looked with a colleague, a very good econometrician, we looked at the facts, you know, how do interest rates actually relate to economic growth? And we found that the correlation was not negative, as we're told, you know, lower rates and higher growth are linked together and higher rates and lower growth. No, there's no evidence for that whatsoever. It's extremely strongly shown by the data. We're looking at, you know, the four major big economies, US, UK, Japan, Germany, over half a century mostly. And we show that the correlation is actually not negative, but positive. So high growth and high rates go together, low growth and low rates. The next question is causation, because central banks, of course, say that, well, we lower rates and that will affect the economy. So causation from rates to growth. And we found again that that's not supported by the empirical evidence. There's much more evidence that the causation runs the other way around. So the economic growth affects interest rates. And so instead of the official story that lower rates lead to higher growth and higher rates lead to lower growth, we have empirically a very clear-cut case for the opposite in two dimensions, namely higher growth leads to higher rates. And lower growth leads to lower rates. And that's quite profound because, I mean, that means many things. For instance, traditional monetary policy cannot possibly work. So what have these central banks been doing for several decades? They claim that's how they've been operating, but it's actually impossible. So they must have been operating in a different way. And the official narrative cannot be true. Of course, that raises a number of other questions, like how does the economy then actually work? And what I've been demonstrating my work is that it goes back to actually the very neglected role of the banks. The banks are not just financial intermediaries. They're very much at the center of the economy and of economic growth and what happens in the economy. Also, the distribution of income and wealth and how unequal and inequitable or not the economy develops very much depends on the banking system. Surprise, surprise, which economists tend not to analyze, certainly until 2008, it's been completely neglected. And there've been, concerning the banking system, there have been also different schools of thought, and there's been a big debate. The dominant school of thought since the 1960s, so for the last, I don't know, 60 years, has been that banks are just financial intermediaries, and therefore we don't really need to look at them. They're not special. They're just like non-bank financial intermediaries, like financial markets in general. So we don't need to single them out. We don't need to study them. That's been dominant also in the US leading academic journals and, textbooks and so on. That's taught at leading universities. But it's been an older narrative from the 1930s to the 1960s, which is the fractional reserve theory of banking, which says that yes, banks are individually financial intermediaries, but somehow, as all the banks work together and link together, something strange happens in their interaction. Money is being created. And that, of course, is where people's ears prick up. What money is being created? Money creation. And we talk about the money multiplier. That's an interesting concept. But that's actually only the second of these three theories. There's a third theory, and that one is the oldest. Was dominant until the 1920s. And that one said that banks are actually not financial intermediaries. They're not financial intermediaries individually or in aggregate. Banks are something else. They're actually creators of the money supply. And each individual bank, when it gives out a bank loan, is actually adding new money to the money supply. And this is the credit creation theory of banking. Now, when you have different theories of something, and there's a dispute, and this has been raging for at least a century, with famous economists supporting almost each school of thought, some strangely like Keynes supporting all three of them in sequence, moving further away from the truth, as it turns out. In any case, when there's a dispute, what's the scientific thing to do? It surely is to look at the data and empirically test the theories and see which one is actually accurate. And so that's what I did.
Yeah, to be clear, you provided the first empirical studies showing that banks create money, which does support the credit creation theory, correct?
That's right. That's right. Exactly. That was published in 2014. A second one published in 2016. The 2014 one you can look up, it's open access. Can banks individually create money out of nothing? It's the title of the paper, and the answer is yes, they can, and they do. So the credit creation theory of banking is correct, and both the fractional reserve theory and also the financial intermediation theory of banking is incorrect. It's been rejected by the data, and I think that's now not any more disputed since I published that paper. The central banks have been scrambling to quickly also admit, oh, yes, that's true. Oh, we suddenly discovered, Miss Hudak, we've discovered banks create money. Who would have thought that? So they came out with all their reports, falling over themselves to quickly add to my empirical evidence. Of course, their reports are only mere assertions, and they've been asserting for decades the opposite. So how do we trust that? I think we do have to look at the empirical evidence. That's what I showed in my papers. Banks create money out of nothing when they lend. And so this is an important other pillar of the central banking narrative that has collapsed. And so, and of course, that if you go through this narrative, it turns out that every single pillar has by now collapsed. Markets are not in equilibrium. Markets are in disequilibrium. Markets are rationed. I write about that in my book, New Paradigm in Macroeconomics, in greater detail. But essentially, it's a very simple analysis. In order to have equilibrium, we need all these this long list of completely implausible assumptions to hold. And what's the probability of these assumptions to hold simultaneously? Because it's, you know, joint probability. They all need to hold together. They need to hold up simultaneously. And it's, you know, we've got at least eight assumptions. Even if the probability of one assumption to be true was 50%, which is excessively high, then the joint probability of all eight assumptions to hold is less than 1%. So it's clear we cannot have equilibrium. That was another fairy tale. And that means all markets are rationed, and rationed markets are determined by quantities. And there's one principle, namely the short side principle, which means that whichever quantity of demand or supply is smaller determines the outcome. And the reality is that essentially all markets are rationed. But also there's one more important, very important result from that once we admit this reality, namely the concept of power enters economics. And that's what the official narrative tries to avoid. I mean, most people know this is common sense that power relations exist, also and especially in the economy. But once you have a realistic economic model and you don't assume equilibrium, then you realize how this works. Think about the labor market. You know, the labor market is a good example. Well, all markets are supposed to be in equilibrium. Well, if you apply for a job, you will find out, I mean, most likely, that there's other applicants for that same job. And when they make a selection, they tend not to ask you, what is the lowest salary you're willing to work for? Now, that will be if the price is the key variable determining the outcome. But they never ask that question. So since the price is already given, how do they select? Well, it's not a market. It is a disequilibrium, and therefore you have essentially bureaucrats that make an allocation decision. We're going to hire you, Ms. Hudak. Congratulations. We're not going to hire the others. So how was that decision made? Well, I always ask my students, think of jobs that are actually not that difficult. And you may slightly disagree with this one, but I always give this example of a job that I think is not difficult and all my students can do well, namely the job of newsreader in a television news program. I mean, how difficult can it get? So, since essentially most people qualify for this job, it's clear that there's more supply of labor for this job than there's demand for this labor. You know, we don't have such a large number of television stations and news programs. There is a limit. And especially since the job is reasonably well paid, and you get some perks, you get, you know, quite well known, you get famous. In some countries, the newsreaders become presidents later when they retire because they're so well known, you know. So clearly, you know, and you can earn money for advertising and all sorts of other perks, right? So it is an easy job that's highly attractive, and therefore clearly there will be many applicants. So how is this market in equilibrium? Of course it's not. The short side, which has the power, is the side that selects. And we just need to very briefly mention Hollywood, and then you know what I'm talking about. The producers make the decisions who's going to be in key movies, who's going to be a star, and gets paid millions for a job that maybe is also not that difficult as it's made out to be. I mean, you've got to be able to move around compared to a newsreader. So, you know, if you can walk and move your limbs, then you can also. Memory is less important nowadays than in the past. So I guess still many people qualify for this job. How do they get selected? Well, the short side has power and selects. So now that's a principle that applies to, and to all markets. And the short side usually abuses this power because, you can ask for things, and this is what happens in reality. Now you'll say, well, hang on, surely this doesn't happen in the bond market. That's a very liquid, big market. Surely there we have equilibrium. Well, only people who haven't traded bonds would say that, because once you've traded bonds, you realize that bonds are very, very specific. I've got in my portfolio, say, Turkey 2035, 9.5%, and then a few more conditions, a very specific particular bond. And if there's pressure and I have to sell it quickly, I need somebody who wants to buy exactly this bond. That's the reality. So there is actually not necessarily equilibrium even in the bond market. So it's true for all markets. And that's the reality. So that part of the narrative has also collapsed. In fact, every single part has collapsed. And the reality then becomes that markets are not really the self-regulating mechanism that we're told. Clever government intervention is actually can be quite successful because markets are not even in equilibrium. This idea that governments are always going to affect the economy negatively, no matter what they do, of course, was already disproven by the huge economic success of Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and China, economies that for several decades had double-digit economic growth. And they did this based on policies that assumed markets are not in equilibrium, that are rationed, and therefore were the opposite of what the mainstream economists and the central bank narrative, which is also supported by the IMF and the World Bank, giving development advice to the whole world, what they were saying. So it's the opposite of those policies, namely to deregulate, liberalize, and privatize. The successfully developed economies did the opposite. The World Bank and the IMF have tried now, since the early, 1950s, allegedly to help countries develop. Which country has actually successfully and decisively moved from developing country status to developed country status? Well, there isn't a single one that has done this based on IMF and World Bank advice. We have a handful of countries, namely the East Asian high growth economies, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and for the last 40 years, China. And the policies they took were the opposite of the IMF and World Bank deregulation, liberalization, and privatization policies. In fact, they took policies which were very clever, that used design of institutions and incentive mechanisms, and also used banks very cleverly, because banks create the money supply, and they also make, like everyone in the economy, because markets are rationed, allocation decisions. Namely, when a bank gives out a loan, it can decide essentially over something that affects all of us, namely because it's new money creation, this loan. Will this money be used for productive purposes that implements new technologies and therefore adds to value and therefore delivers new economic growth and prosperity and therefore also new jobs without inflation? Now, that's the ideal scenario. That is possible. But that's only one of several scenarios. If banks do that, we get high economic growth without inflation, without banking crisis, without boom and bust cycles. And that's what Asia, East Asian successful economies did. But banks can also do something else. They can lend money for consumption. Then you get consumer price inflation because suddenly there's more money created demanding things, but the same amount of goods and services. So you're pushing up consumer prices. And more importantly, for the last several decades, has been another case. Namely, banks create money through lending, and they give this new money and therefore new purchasing power to those who simply purchase existing assets. Now, that doesn't contribute to GDP at all, because asset transactions are not even part of GDP. But what it does is it creates new money, it injects it into these asset markets, and therefore must be pushing up asset prices quite clearly. And therefore, you will get, if banks lend a lot for property purchases, obviously you're going to get a property boom. If they lend a lot for financial transactions to hedge funds, to private equity funds, that all work on the basis of bank lending leverage. That's the real source, the secret of their success. The real source is this leverage that they create, and that turns their tiny returns into big returns. And it works because of the money creation power of banks. money creation injected now into these markets where they're purchasing and therefore driving up asset prices. But that's a Ponzi scheme. It's a pyramid scheme because, I mean, it works while banks keep creating more money, pumping it into asset markets, because then asset prices go up. But it works only while the music is playing, while the banks continue to create money for asset purchases. The moment the music stops, that moment, asset prices won't go up anymore. They start to stagnate or go down. And then the late coming speculators, they need continuing rises in asset prices. They will start not to have that. They will start to, well, get margin calls, repay the loans. Well, they can't. They start to go bankrupt. And then the whole thing unravels. You get non-performing loans that makes banks risk averse. They reduce lending. And then the whole spiral goes negative. And banks also start to reduce lending to the real economy. And then we have both a banking crisis due to non-performing assets. Banks have very little equity, which is the source of the, you have to use equity if you have non-performing loans on the asset side. So that's quickly used up. You have a banking crisis then and the big economic recession. That's, of course, what happened in Japan since the 1990s for several decades. But it's the same mechanism that has happened time and again and also in many other countries. So the reality is quite different from the central banking narrative. And it's now clear to many people that this narrative has completely collapsed. I mean, there's no evidence of this narrative whatsoever. And the empirical data suggests the opposite. And that's an interesting moment in time, because then that raises other questions, such as how are central bankers handling this reality?
Certainly. So to be clear, Professor Werner, much of what we have been told about economics is not true. So has the public been deceived?
Effectively, yes. Now, you can talk about the intention or not, but the fact is the public has been told for far too long a narrative that simply is not true. It's a fairy tale. In most cases, as a simple rule of thumb, you just, you know, if economics, mainstream economics, says one thing, you just take the opposite. Then you're likely to be, you'd be accurate in that. So yes, as a rule of thumb, you know, you can more or less take the opposite of what economics says, and you're likely to be right.
Now, you coined the term quantitative easing. Can you please explain to us what it is and how it relates to the response to COVID-19?
Well, I proposed this new monetary policy, which I called quantitative easing, in print in 1995. I spoke about it already a bit earlier, 1994, but in print it was 1995, 2nd of September, in one of the largest newspapers, daily newspapers in the world, the Nikkei, Nihon Keizai Shimbun, the main Japanese financial newspaper, which, by the way, nowadays owns the Financial Times, and which is, by the way, also a newspaper that's been very close to central banks and their narrative. Now, I made this proposal of this new policy because at that time, in these years, 93, 94, 95, I observed that the Japanese economy, and I should add, of course, I was based in Tokyo at the time, I observed that the Japanese banking system, which in the early 90s was essentially the, you know, the top banks in the world, the 20 biggest banks in the world were all Japanese. That strong and sort of leading banking system, in my view, was about to go bankrupt. I'd warned about that in 1991. And, you know, to me, that was about to happen. I saw further and further evidence for that. And therefore, I'd been thinking about how to sort of quickly solve that pending and imminent incipient problem of the banking system collapsing very, very soon in Japan. And of course, when I said this, most people would have disagreed. Japanese banks going bankrupt, completely out of the question. This guy has no idea. This is sort of, you know, opposition I faced. But I was unfazed because it was so obvious that it wouldn't happen. So I focused mainly on trying to come up with solutions on how to get out of the following crisis when the banks essentially stop lending, burdened with big bad debts, balance sheets impaired, and they cannot lend anymore. And because of this lack of bank credit going into the real economy transactions, of course, GDP will stagnate and you get a recession. So it's not rocket science, really. So then my main concern was, how can we quickly get out? And standard monetary policy can't do that job, particularly this, the official monetary policy lowering interest rates. I even said in this article in 95, or in other articles, I said, and the interest rates were still around sort of on the long bond, 4.7% until February 95. You can lower rates to zero. It's not going to help. I was trying to be dramatic. Little did I know that the Bank of Japan was actually going to do just that in the following years, therefore very nicely proving me right. Namely, you lowered them to zero, it's not going to help. So that interest rate policy is not going to help. Why? Because rates follow growth. They don't lead growth. And of course, the reason why they're going down to zero is because they've allowed the economy to shrink and there's no economic growth. That's pushing down rates. And the other policies were fiscal policies. That's the sort of knee-jerk reaction also in Japan when there's a recession. But pure fiscal policy doesn't create any economic growth because pure fiscal policy, especially the way it's done in Japan, fully funded by bond issuance, it puts money into the economy the right hand, but then where does this money come from? The government issues bonds and therefore takes the same money out of the economy the left hand. So it's not going to have any impact, right? You take the money from the economy as bond issuance and then you put the same money back in. You get some redistribution, usually from the many to the few, from the taxpayer to the bondholders and things like that. And the recipients of the construction orders to build another bridge and whatever. But the overall economy is not going to grow because in total you haven't increased credit creation, new purchasing power for productive transactions in the economy. And that's also what then happened. The economy was not responding to fiscal stimulation. So I proposed a new monetary policy, which had to be different. And when I said we need monetary stimulation, which is what I did say, everyone was immediately saying, oh, interest rate reductions. You mean we need lower rates? No, that's not what I mean. So it's clear that I had to point this out that I'm not talking about the price of money. I am talking about the quantity of money. But the moment I said quantity of money, I said, ah, you're a monetarist. You want, high-powered money, M0 or M1, M2, M3, these traditional monetarist aggregates to go up. But no, that's not what I was saying. Because the monetarist approach had also failed because it looks at the wrong thing. All these M's are deposit aggregates, but deposits is money out of circulation. These are savings. We don't need more savings. We have excess savings. So it's actually the money creation process that I was pointing to, credit creation. And so my true definition of quantitative easing was we need to expand bank credit creation in the economy. And there's a few things the central bank can do directly. To partly substitute for the banks, but also to help the banks to create credit, such as purchasing their non-performing assets at face value, putting them on the central bank balance sheet and helping the banks that way. And also the government can do a few things, namely stopping the issuance of bonds and instead borrowing the public sector purchasing power requirement directly from the banking system. Then you're backing the fiscal spending with new money creation in the banking system, credit creation. That goes into GDP. You get a recovery because credit creation is rising. So that's my true definition of quantitative easing. And for years, the central bank, the Bank of Japan, said, oh, what this guy says is nonsense. Other commentators also said, it's nonsense. We don't need this. But they tried their alternative policies, interest rates to zero. That didn't help. And so by 2001, so 6 years later, they then sort of said, okay, well, let's try this quantitative easing. But unfortunately, by that time, they'd managed to change the definition to this traditional monetarist definition of high-powered money. Increase banks' reserves at the central bank, which doesn't do the economy any good whatsoever, which I'd always been saying. And so in a way, the central bank really wanted to disprove quantitative easing by defining it wrongly. In a way where, they said it wouldn't work, and I was agreeing with them because, yeah, increasing banks' reserves at the central bank doesn't help the economy at all. But that's not QE. That's not the true QE. So by 2006, the Bank of Japan said, oh, we've tried this QE and it doesn't work, so we're going to stop it. And, I did write in those days about how they wrongly interpreted it, but I mostly left it at that. But then once the 2008 crisis happened, the Bank of England came out and said, we're going to introduce quantitative easing. It's kind of surprising. They did this in March 2009, because only 3 years before, the Bank of Japan had given up quantitative easing, what they called quantitative easing, on the basis that it didn't work. And that was the moment in time when I decided, okay, I have to come out here and explain to people what quantitative easing really is, the original definition, and also how to do it correctly. And interestingly, the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, he was the only central banker who listened, because he came closer to my definition of quantitative easing in a number of aspects. I mean, he pointed out that he did not want to do it the same way as the Bank of Japan, because he felt it didn't work, and that's true, and that they defined it incorrectly. And he, in a speech over here in London, 2009, January, he said that it's more like credit easing, which is closer to my definition of, you know, credit creation. And he did also implement my recommendation to get rid of the bad debts in the banking system by the central bank simply purchasing the non-performing assets from the banks at clearly more than market value, more or less at face value, and the banking system is saved. And this is what happened in America. That's how the Fed bailed out the banking system. It completely multiplied the Federal Reserve balance sheet, but it didn't create money. And that's why in those days, I was saying, some people were saying, oh, wow, look at the Fed balance sheet. That's going to lead to inflation and the dollar is going to collapse. And I was pointing out, no, this is not going to happen. Why? This is not money creation. Balance sheet data as such, without knowing what's really happening, doesn't really tell you that much, because it was not money creation. It was simply an operation within the banking system, the central bank purchasing non-performing assets from the banks. That doesn't inject any money into the non-bank sector and therefore cannot lead to inflation. And we didn't have inflation. It also can't collapse the dollar, because it doesn't actually create net new dollars. We just helped the banks, and that led to this balance sheet nominal expansion, but it's not money creation. And that's where I come to the second part of your question, because when we now look at what happened in 2020, it is very different. And I did point this out already last year in 2020 from April, May onwards. So it's very different to 2008. The QE that was implemented in 2020 was QE that did expand the money supply a lot. And therefore, I've been warning of inflation, and we are now seeing the evidence already in that there is inflation, 4%, 5%, or perhaps a bit more. So it's all coming up now. And the reason, well, the reason is, of course, that now money was created and injected into the economy in most countries, the US, the UK, continental Europe, Eurozone, Japan. And therefore, you know, that's according to my quantity theory of disaggregated credit, or the general quantity theory based on credit, disaggregated. You see that when you do that, you create more credit for GDP transactions, you get more nominal GDP growth. And since you haven't increased real GDP to some extent, you will get inflation. So that's what's happening. Of course, at the same time, we still have the ongoing asset inflation as central banks create money for asset purchases, and the banking system also supporting that. So if you look at what's going to happen next, I mean, at the moment, the scenario is still very bullish for asset markets. It is a bubble, but they continue to blow up this bubble. Concerning inflation, at the moment, I believe they've actually reduced the credit creation in order to prevent runaway inflation, where you'd, the current 4, 5, 6% inflation moves into double digits. I think they're still saving that scenario for the future. It's not quite yet happening, but we need to follow this data very closely. Of course, this could be done and could happen at any moment.
Let's now shift our focus to macroeconomics in the context of COVID-19. For more than 5 years, you have been warning that central banks are waging war against cash and against banks as they prepare to launch their own digital currencies. So how do the regulations to control the spread of COVID-19 advance the central bank's efforts to create their own digital currency?
Yes, I mean, this war on cash has been visible, of course, and as many examples of members from various central banks and also from the IMF saying, oh, cash is bad, suddenly. Suddenly it was all terrorism and drug dealers that suddenly the central banks were concerned with, which is a bit curious. So that's one strand. But also, actually, there's another war going on, and this is really the war, the undeclared war against banks. That's been raging for the last, well, certainly decade, but probably longer than that, maybe 2 or 3 decades. Because if you look at the number of banks in major economies, you see that they've been going down a lot. Since the ECB has been created, that's one of the the newest major central banks. I mean, it's only 21 years old or so. Since it's been created in this time period, 5,000 banks have disappeared in the Eurozone. That's a lot. And these banks, you know, they were not the big banks. They were small banks. So what we see is the death of small local banks, community banks that are being forced to merge and disappear. Why is that? Why are they disappearing? And this is true also for the US. The US is the country with the largest number of banks. And that's actually one of the strengths of the US banking system, that we have many, many small banks, because that actually means that you have lenders that support small firms. And small firms are the backbone of any economy. In the US, in Germany, in Japan, in China, the majority of jobs, the majority of employment is with small firms. They account for 70 to 80% of total employment in all economies. And therefore, you need really lending to small firms, but big banks don't lend to small firms. It's one of the principles in banking. It's really only small banks that lend to small firms. And therefore, you need to constantly create new banks, small banks, as there's pressure for banks to merge over time. So why have they disappeared? Well, two reasons. One is regulatory policies. They become stricter and stricter. And certainly in Europe, the small banks have suffered most from that. They've had to follow the same rules as the big banks in terms of regulation and compliance. Now, Deutsche Bank can afford to have 2,000 compliance staff, but a small community bank with 20 staff can't afford to have even two compliance staff. You know, it's not possible, it's not viable. So they have to give up and they merge with a larger bank. And this has been happening. So the regulatory burden has been one reason. That's a policy variable. The US has been smarter on this because in the US there is a separate regulator for small banks. And that ability to be, you know, appropriate and sort of proportionate, you know, small banks are not systemically relevant. They should not have to meet the same standards as, you know, a global and you know, systemically important bank. But in Europe, that's been totally ignored. Secondly, central banks have been adopting monetary policies that have not been helping banks at all, quite the contrary. Namely, by pushing down interest rates and pushing down the whole yield curve to zero and flattening the yield curve, or even inverting the yield curve where, you know, the long end has lower interest rates than the short end. These sort of policies that will punish those banks that do the productive lending for small businesses, for, you know, productive business investment, that becomes not viable. And only the speculative banks that, you know, get money to invest and speculate in the financial markets and assets, only they will make money. And so this is also what's been happening. So the monetary policy has consistently hurt small banks, small productive banks that are good for economic growth. That's, of course, why economic growth has really been stagnating, and we'll do that more as more banks disappear. So now comes the further restrictions of the COVID era from March 2020 last year onwards. And this really plays into the same development, not only on the surface. You know, some people noticed that from March onwards, immediately central banks were saying, oh, cash is bad. The virus could be on cash. We need to switch to digital currency. And immediately they were holding more seminars about central bank digital currencies, trying to get onto this bandwagon and have another reason why they're arguing for central bank digital currencies. And really, if you put these developments together, so we've got the war on cash, the war on banks, the introduction of central bank digital currencies, what you see is that really the banking system is threatened, because when the central bank issues what's called central bank digital currency, in a way that's a euphemism. You could rephrase this and you could say that, well, the central bank is now going to offer current accounts to the public. So instead of you having your current account, your normal checking account with the local credit union or local community bank, You can have it with the Federal Reserve. Oh, that sounds good. Sounds safe. If there's a crisis, well, why not have it with the Fed? So you can see how more and more people will switch their accounts to the central bank. But hang on, isn't the central bank the regulator of the banks? Yes, it is. So is this a level playing field? If the regulator suddenly says, oh, I'm going to step into the arena, the umpire in the game says, oh, actually, I'm going to join the game. I'm going to compete against the players. And by the way, I will still be the umpire. I will still make up rules and I'll still say red card for you and I'm sending you out. But I'm also playing and I'm going to shoot some goals now, score some goals now. I mean, that's what we're witnessing. The central banks, the regulators saying we're going to compete against our regulated, the banks. This really is a declaration of, I don't know, of war perhaps. I don't know. It's certainly quite shocking. It certainly rips up what seems to have been an agreement between the banks and the central bank for the past 200, 300 years, whereby the central bank is more powerful. That's recognized. Nobody's disputing that, and is, given this powerful role over banks. But in exchange, it lets the banks earn a living and have a life as those who deal with the public. So it's a two-tier system. But when the regulator says, no, actually, no, we're going to deal directly with the public, and the regulator is clearly more powerful, then you are effectively driving out the banking system. And that is the threat, particularly put together with the other policies that central banks have pursued over the past 20, 30 years, constantly stricter regulations on the banks, which hurts the banks, and then monetary policies that drives out banks. And in Europe, in the Eurozone, has killed 5,000 banks in just 20 years. Put together, that looks like that could be a consistent policy. And then, of course, the COVID agenda has really furthered this. And in a way, it's also put a further time bomb into the banking system, because the banks have been told to increase lending now because we have a crisis, we have a pandemic. And so their lending to small firms has been stepped up a lot. And so we can expect further non-performing loans in the future when, somehow we'll see the results of that. So far, it's too early, but it's predictable that there'll be a lot of non-performing assets. As we know that the unusual restrictions, I mean, these are sort of Soviet-style, Stalinist Soviet-style restrictions on economic activity, that they are really killing small firms, which are, of course, the main customers of small banks, and that puts banks into under pressure.
Exactly. Now, how would you characterize these economic policies implemented since March 2020, including the restrictions and lockdowns, as well as public money injections into the economy?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, when we look for precedents, you have to, in history, you have to look at, well, quite a few countries, and you'll find that you will not see precedents in liberal free market economies, actually. The main precedents that are similar are in totalitarian regimes. So we seem to have entered the era of extraordinary and very much totalitarian type of interventions in the economy, which is quite interesting because we earlier said that the central banking narrative is free markets, but suddenly we've really pivoted without losing any thought to the opposite extreme, where you have complete direct government intervention in an extraordinary range of markets and people's private lives, affecting the freedom of movement and so on. And so, well, the Soviet Union comes to mind, also maybe Germany in the 1930s, under National Socialist policies. And then on the other hand, well, I hope it's not going to be like the so-called Cultural Revolution in China, which is another example. I mean, maybe this is what could be up next. I hope not. But what happened there was the government actually took policies that could not help, could not fail to reduce the food supply, and created a famine, an artificially created famine that killed 20 million people in China. And so, while some people say we have early stages of some strange policies that seem to negatively affect, you know, food distribution and food supply, and quite unnecessarily. So I hope we're not moving in that direction. But one thing is clear, that we have to look for comparison to Soviet-style totalitarian regimes, which is really not good news.
In your book, Princes of the Yen, which has also been created into a documentary, you suggest that in order to implement change politically, economically, or otherwise, there needs to be a crisis. You have also raised this point during several interviews.
I met one guy who was quite open about that. He said, Richard, yeah, sure, we could have printed more money, we could have created a recovery, but then nothing would have changed. Japan's economic structure would not have changed.
The Ministry of Finance has been legally in control for most of the post-war era. We've got entrenched bureaucratic structures, politicians, and all these cartels and so on. That was the old system. Well, history teaches the system changes only fundamentally if there's a crisis. What is the goal of monetary policy? It is to change the economic structure. Now, how do you do that? Well, you need a crisis, and that's really what they've done. They've created a crisis to change the economic structure.
Richard, we're just out of time. I have to cut you off. Thank you so much, and we apologize.
Is it possible that this strategy is currently being used to establish a central bank digital currency?
Well, it seems to be a fact that some influential people are pushing for a so-called Great Reset. And they have said on the record, and you know, various influential people, whether at the World Economic Forum or in political positions or in even, I think, in ECB high-ranking positions, have said things like, oh, this is an opportunity, a window of opportunity, you know, that we should use. So this dreadful and very much artificially created crisis based on lockdowns is seen as something positive, an opportunity, and that's the usual narrative. I mean, I'm so used to this narrative that the recession in Japan, for example, the Bank of Japan said repeatedly, the recession is not such a bad thing, it's actually an opportunity. Thanks to the recession, we can now understand that we need deregulation, liberalization, and privatization. We need to change the system, change the economic structure to a different system, and have political changes and so on. This narrative that you essentially can promote structural change, deep transformation of the economy, of a political system, and implement changes when you have a crisis, and therefore crisis are a good thing, is sort of a pattern that we've seen in many places and used by many decision makers, and that's shown in great detail in my book Princes of the Yen, which you can get at quantumpublishers.com, by the way. And I show this in great detail. I particularly look at the Japanese case, the Bank of Japan, but also there's a chapter on Asia, on the Asian crisis, where we see again the same pattern. This happened to Korea, to Thailand, and Indonesia in the Asian crisis 1997. And there's a chapter on the European Central Bank. And of course, the ECB has really been following the textbook. I mean, this book was out in 2003. And at that time, I predicted and warned that the ECB was likely to create bank credit driven asset bubbles, banking crises, large recessions, and large scale unemployment in the Eurozone. And, you know, within a year, they started doing this. In Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Greece. And by 2011, it was complete. We had record high youth unemployment, 50% in Greece and Spain. And that was because the ECB actually is not the continuation of the German central bank, the Bundesbank, which had a very good track record. I explain how the ECB is really the revived Reichsbank, the predecessor of the Weimar era, and there are quite some shocking parallels. And so it looks like we are moving in the footsteps of the Reichsbank, which is one of the worst central banks.
Earlier, you mentioned that we could be facing inflation. Now, in Germany, in the Weimar Republic after World War I, there was terrible hyperinflation. Could this scenario happen again?
Well, the answer, unfortunately, has to be yes. I hope it's not going to happen. At the moment, we don't have the necessary conditions in place so that we don't yet have to expect it. However, there are some parallels because also the Weimar Republic suffered initially from lockdowns and shutdowns of entire industries. The big industrial area in Germany was the Ruhr area, and that was foreign occupied in the first years of the Weimar Republic. And as a result of the foreign occupation, which was not really in line with international treaties, all the workers of the companies there started a strike. And so suddenly production was halted. So you had essentially what is a lockdown, a supply side shock. And that was one of the ingredients in this economic mix that started to happen. And of course, the central bank also played an important role. It took policies which were quite irresponsible, and the central bank was a key player in both creating the hyperinflation, but then also in the following situation after the hyperinflation, getting industry indebted and increasing foreign indebtedness. US dollar short-term denominated loans from the US became dominant in the German banking system and in industry, and that's a time bomb which was set off in 1931, and therefore creating the large-scale unemployment and exporting essentially the Great Depression from the US to Germany. So the central bank, the Reichsbank, was a key factor there. But it's clear that this hyperinflation was a combination of supply side factors and irresponsible central bank policies. And well, of course, we have experienced similar supply side factors, small firms being essentially told to shut down, thousands of people becoming unemployed, and also at the same time, central banks expanding money creation very aggressively. So these are clear parallels. Fortunately, I would say at the moment, it doesn't add up to hyperinflation yet, but it's something we need to watch. And the hyperinflation scenario, I think, is not yet out of question. And policymakers can, decide about this. So we need to keep watching.
I want to now discuss the World Economic Forum's Great Reset. But before we get into stakeholder capitalism, I want to talk about your experience with the WEF. In 2003, you were awarded Global Leader for Tomorrow by the WEF and even met Klaus Schwab. However, you were never invited back to Davos. Now, few people, of course, have direct experience with the very people who are advocating for the Great Reset. So can you please share with us your encounter?
Yes. So I was there actually for 2 years. I was invited in 2003 as Global Leader for Tomorrow, together with 30 or 40 other young people from all over the world selected. And initially, it is quite exciting because you meet all these leaders. President Clinton was there, and British, German leaders, everyone is there. I met Merkel, and she wasn't even chancellor yet. So you see the future leaders there as well. I met Klaus Schwab, and I just sensed that he wasn't so keen to meet me and talk to me. He seemed to know about me. I've found that with several other people there. Yes, he wasn't really keen to engage in small talk or anything. But maybe a difference was that I and also several others in the cohort, we asked a lot of questions, and they were usually critical questions. There was a big presentation I remember on GMO seeds, and I asked about the reduced yield of GMO seeds once you harvest, and you can't replant because the crop yield is so low, or they're almost dead, which means it's just a trick. You're distorting nature to then exploit the farmers, and they constantly have to buy new seeds, things like that. So I would engage with that and have debates, and that wasn't so welcome. Or when I sat next to Larry Summers, Treasury Secretary, or had Trichet giving a speech about how we need structural transformation, I asked him in front of everyone, where is that in the mandate of the ECB, to tell governments to make structural reforms of their economy. It's not the mandate of the central bank.
The gentleman over there. Yes, please.
My name is Richard Werner. I'm an economist. My question is for Monsieur Trichet, who's also been for years member of the governing council of the ECB. The question is, where in the Maastricht Treaty or ECB statutes does it say that it's the job of the ECB to back structural reform or any other political agenda?
I said very, very clearly, and we have all said very, very clearly, that we had no responsibility in this domain. We have a voice, and we say in this domain and in some others what we think. And perhaps if we can help in explaining from our side to the general people that they would be better off, perhaps it would help Europe embarking in this implementation of structural reforms, which is so important. And there is a consensus on that. The diagnosis, again, is a very, very, very large consensus on this point.
That didn't go down too well, I suspect, and may have been the reason why after the second year, we were told, everyone was told, oh, sorry, this Global Leader for Tomorrow program had to be abolished for I don't know what reason. Sorry. But then a few months later, we noticed that, oh, they have a new program, which they didn't tell us about. It's called Young Global Leader, which is essentially the same. So they just got rid of this cohort by changing the program.
We hear a lot about stakeholder capitalism from the WEF and from people like Klaus Schwab. You have previously said to me that stakeholder capitalism is a positive economic concept which allows for ordinary people, not just stakeholders, to benefit from capitalism. However, it seems as if the WEF is taking this positive concept and inverting it.
Yes, I was actually surprised when I found out that Klaus Schwab and his friends at talking about stakeholder capitalism, because their definition is clearly very different. It's a concept that was developed in Germany in the first half of the 20th century. And the idea is that it's not just shareholders who are the owners of a company who should have an influence over things. And actually, in reality, when you have a diverse set of, you know, shareholders, when it's a listed company, often the shareholders are so dissipated that they don't actually have much influence over the company. And then it's the managers who decide everything. But that's also not good, because there's other stakeholders. I mean, there's employees, ordinary employees. There's the general public. Often companies have very important roles that affect the whole economy or society. And so the stakeholder concept originally means that companies have a responsibility to society. And when you have ordinary common sense people in the functions in the company, actually, they would probably act in the right way. But when you have this shareholder, value maximization approach, then everything gets very distorted. And the stakeholder capitalism approach just says that we shouldn't just look at things that are good for the top management and for the shareholders, which is usually about squeezing as much profits out and being very ruthless and often very unethical in your policies, you know, to put it clearly. And so stakeholder capitalism is about being ethical, thinking about how a company affects society, and thinking of other stakeholders, ordinary, not just ordinary customers, but also others in society, including families of, you know, subcontractors and suppliers, and even those who have nothing directly to do with the company, but they're in the same town or the same, city, and will be affected in various ways. So it's a broader concept, and the idea is that companies have responsibility to society and to stakeholders. That's not, I think, the definition that Klaus Schwab has in mind, so that's important to point out.
What do you think the definition is that they have in mind?
I think to them, it's just more of the mainstream narrative, you know, more excuses for why companies should squeeze their staff and should squeeze consumers and should have unethical policies that are actually not good for society. So I think it's more or less the opposite.
Now, with regard to stakeholder capitalism, we have heard the phrase, you will own nothing and be happy. Can you explain to us what that really means?
Well, I probably can't be entirely sure what they mean, but to me it sounds like that the very small number of large-scale owners and shareholders in, you know, dominant shareholders in the largest company in the world will be very happy if the majority of the people don't own anything and are renting everything from them, because then they will receive the rent and they will own all the assets. And of course, you know, there's a difference between being an owner and being somebody who rents and just pays a fee. Because really the owner is in charge and is in control. Earlier I mentioned, you know, the power dimension which exists in the economy and in society, and particularly the weaker ones and financially weaker ones feel this, you know, this power dimension. And if you're a big asset owner, you have much more power in many ways. Literally, you have more freedom to make decisions. And those who don't have assets, they have fewer choices, less power, and they constantly have to pay a rental fee. So it's really ideal for the large-scale owners to have a system where the majority of the population doesn't own anything and pays rental fees, and that will make these asset owners very, very happy.
Now, the stakeholder capitalism also sounds a lot like looking out for society as well as the environment, and there has been an emphasis on sustainability and climate change. How does this tie into the Great Reset?
Well, that's actually an important question. I mean, so again, we have to distinguish between what's a narrative and what stories are being told and the facts. What we have been told recently, the narrative seems to be economic growth is bad. Therefore, we should have less growth. They coined this term degrowth. We need to get rid of growth, which of course will happen as banks get killed, when central bank digital currency gets rolled out and the banking system disappears. There will be no more economic growth. So then they say, oh, that's good for the environment. And so that's the narrative. But what's the reality? What are the facts on this? Well, the fact is economic growth is not necessarily bad for the environment. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. What is bad for the environment is policies and activities that hurt the environment, such as pollution. I think we all agree, if you have pollution of the environment, of rivers and so on, that's bad for the environment. Well, you can have this pollution whether you've got zero growth or 10% growth, right? So clearly it's not the growth that's the problem, it is the pollution activity that's the problem. So you see how very cleverly they're spinning this and they're distracting your attention away from what really hurts the environment. Oh, let's not talk about that. Oh, it's economic growth that's the problem. Well, we're going to have zero growth, then everything will be fine. Well, that's absolutely not true. Where does this come from? Now, what are the facts about economic growth and the environment? The facts are, this is perhaps slightly surprising or shocking, there is no economic growth. Growth doesn't exist. If you ask a physicist, it becomes very clear. We've got the laws of thermodynamics. Energy is a closed system. You can only transform it, but you know you can't make it or make it disappear. We have entropy. So there's no growth. Growth doesn't exist. But hang on, economists talk about growth. So what is the economic growth? Economic growth is a statistical illusion. It's a statistical illusion that was created by taking certain statistics and putting them together to create GDP, which is an artificial concept. We don't have time to go into this, why it was created this way, which is an interesting story, but it was created in a certain way by picking and choosing certain activities and putting it together. And then that's GDP, that's economic growth. You know, when GDP is higher this year than last year, that's our growth. So it's entirely a statistically artificially created concept, and in reality there's no economic growth. And that proves also that growth can't hurt the environment, because there is no growth in terms of physics and energy. Now the good news therefore is we can have very high economic growth, 10%, double digit growth, like China, Japan, Taiwan, Korea have done for decades. We can have that and be good on the environment, you know, have growth that is very green, environmentally very sustainable, and that doesn't hurt the environment. We can have that. It is possible. And so it's a false narrative to say that economic growth is always bad for the environment, and therefore we shouldn't have growth. But it reveals something about people who say this, that what they really want to do is kill growth, and they're just coming up with an excuse, which they try to pull the wool over people's eyes so they believe, oh, yes, yeah, growth is actually bad. Yeah, we should have no growth. And there seem to be people at work to engineer that scenario where we have no growth, namely when you kill small banks, local banks, community banks, and you have a very concentrated banking system that's only a small number of big banks, or you've got rid of the banking system entirely and there's only the central bank left, you will have no more economic growth. I hope that that's not what policymakers are aiming at, because that would not be good. And certainly we should all try to prevent such a scenario becoming true, because it will create many problems. It's like the 20-year zero growth or depression we had in Japan, which causes a lot of hardship in the economy for people. We don't really need that. I mean, there's no real justification for that.
Is the emphasis on sustainability perhaps a globalist initiative to control the population?
Well, I mean, population control is another interesting concept. And of course, it has been linked by some to the environmental damage that humans allegedly cause. You know, the narrative that's being told is that it's really the, we don't want economic growth and we don't want people. But that's a very, very unhealthy thought process, I must say. I mean, it's anti-human thought process that the source of all the problems are humans. I think it's the other way around. And I told you at the beginning, essentially, with economists, you just have to take the opposite of what they say. The solution is humans. Humans are the creative ones. They're the ones that come up with new ideas, new patterns, new inventions. Nobody else does. And so if we want more prosperity, we need more humans. Of course, we need to train them. The education system is very important. But that's how we get prosperity, and how historically society is always thrived, is when we have more people and people are also educated. There's no evidence that, you know, having more people is bad for the planet, but it is a narrative that's been scarily out there for decades. There is a United Nations Population Fund, which is a big international organization, and it seems that despite its name, the actual goal is to reduce the population of the world. And one could say that certain policies that have been taken since March 2020 seem to be part of this agenda, and that is quite concerning. So it is certainly a topic we should look at in the future in great detail.
Professor Werner, I know that so much of your work has really challenged the mainstream narratives and accepted concepts within economics. And I understand that you are engaged with several lawsuits in English employment courts concerning your employment as professor at the University of Southampton and the University of Cambridge. Is it appropriate for me to ask about these cases, and perhaps if they are in any way related to your challenging the official narrative when it comes to the central banks?
Well, since the court reporters have been reporting on this, I suppose it is out in the public domain. So I suppose I certainly can state those facts that are already out there, which is that I have made claims against these two universities for discriminating against me on a number of counts, including my belief that a concentrated banking system is not good for society, and we need a banking system that is decentralized and has lots of small banks. And so I've caused controversy for advocating community banks, which I think shouldn't really be controversial, because certainly local politicians very quickly get it that when you have small local banks in the vicinity, this is great. You know, you are, even if you don't understand bank credit creation, that these banks are actually creating new money, which will stimulate your local economy. Everyone understands that, you know, giving out loans to small firms locally is going to be good, and it's going to create jobs, and it's really going to create jobs, because if the same money is given to big companies, it's not going to create a single job. So by lending to small firms, you get the job creation, you also get the productive business investment, you get the non-inflationary growth, you get less inequality. What's there not to like it? But somehow that was not a very popular message in the UK. I can only presume it's because the big banks are very, very influential in the UK, and the City of London Corporation in particular. And as a result, and this is my claim in my lawsuits, I was discriminated against by both of these universities quite badly. And so I went to court, and I'm still, standing my ground in court.
And these are, of course, ongoing cases. Perhaps in the future we can follow up with some more details as to how you were discriminated based off of your beliefs, nationality, and your work.
Thank you very much.
Professor Werner, I know many people watching right now are going to be very interested in your perspective on cryptocurrency. So do you mind sharing with us what your outlook is on this new sort of money technology?
Yes, I think it's actually part of the narrative that we've discussed earlier. So I'm glad you mentioned it, because it does fit into this quite nicely. And it also supports the central planner's goal to introduce central bank digital currency, which is really less of a currency, but more a monitoring and surveillance and control tool. And so you'd expect some resistance against that. And I think the cryptocurrencies have two goals when they were introduced. One goal is to enable the central planners to argue for central bank digital currency by saying what, for example, President Lagarde has said about the ECB's plans, evolving plans to introduce central bank digital currency, namely, well, there seems to be demand for this. Look at Bitcoin. We have to react. We're just reacting. So that's why, we can now introduce central bank digital currency, because Bitcoin and the other cyber currencies exist. So we need to do this. That's one function that they clearly serve. The other function that they seem to serve is to take pressure off another asset that has behaved in a very unusual way in the past year, and that is precious metals in general, but particularly gold. Now, our money supply can be called a fiat money supply. You know, it has value by decree, but ultimately this only works while there is still faith in the system, credit. The Latin word credere is faith, to believe. So the credit system that we have is based on belief, and the belief only works if there's some kind of foundation. And when central banks create a lot of money, then this belief, this faith in the system starts to crumble. And normally then you will get the gold price going up. But the gold price has since last year been magically at $1,800 per ounce of gold, fine gold. And that is quite unusual given how other prices have soared. I mean, if you look at timber prices, I think over 100%, lots of raw materials, commodities going up, big double digit or triple digit percentages. But gold seems to have not moved an inch, or very, very little, sideways anyway. And that is unusual. I think my interpretation is that the gold price, I mean, we know is quite manipulated, has been for a long, long time. The biggest owners are central banks, IMF, Bundesbank, Federal Reserve, and others, sort of in that order. And they can, therefore, manipulate the price. And I think they've worked very hard to keep it down. Because once the gold price really takes off, mm-hmm. it's clear to everyone that there is a problem, that we have a systemic problem, a big problem in the system. I personally like gold. I think it's a good asset. One should have it in the portfolio. Historically, it just has the history. No other asset has such a history as gold. And so that's where cyber currencies come in, because that's another way to take pressure off gold. Because, of course, if a lot of people buy gold, and I think we should buy gold, especially since, thanks to the central banks, they've kept it at a low price. Well, hey, take advantage. Buy it. Because I think it will go up by a lot in the future. Anyway, but for central banks, this has been, you know, sort of difficult to keep it at this price level. And for them, it's important that those who normally would buy gold, there's a lot of people when there's a crisis and they look for alternatives or they've started to doubt the central bank policies, they would buy gold. But if there's an alternative, then maybe they buy the alternative and then the gold price can stay at the current level and then job done. And so that is, of course, what Bitcoin and other cybercurrencies have been advertised as. It's the digital gold. It's the modern gold. Well, why don't we buy here? And so that's the second function that it served. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean we should not necessarily, you know, invest a little bit or even more in cybercurrency. So I have some small exposure. I think it makes sense because I think the price will go up further. But you have to be aware. I think ultimately, in the long run, they will disappear when central banks have introduced the central bank digital currencies and they've linked them together internationally and the surveillance and control aspect of central bank digital currency is really being utilized. When we've reached that stage, and we are then talking about a very totalitarian system, unfortunately, then I do not think that they will indulge us by allowing the continuation of these cyber currencies. It's also indicative that initially, already many years ago, you know, they were really promoted by the mainstream media. You know, when Bitcoin was essentially unknown, the Financial Times had one-page big articles introducing Bitcoin, and also, you know, others, Bloomberg and so on, fairly early started to quote Bitcoin as if it was a major asset, which it wasn't at that time at all. So it's clear that the establishment was very much interested in promoting it, and I think it's for these reasons.
Is there anything to be said for the fact that there has been an obvious push for vaccine passports? We're seeing France implement this new vaccine passport system. Does that have anything to do with the push for a central bank digital currency?
Yes, I think that is really on the cards, because, you know, having digital passports, given the nature, the technology of such digital passports, whether it's a vaccine passport or anything else, you know, their nature is that you can link various functionalities. And so it seems just rational that once you introduce one type, that will become the platform for the combination of these functionalities. And so let's say it is started based on an alleged pandemic with, you know, COVID vaccination passports as digital passports, then it would make sense to expand the functionality. They become your passports, not just your digital vaccine passport, but actually your real passport. That is then also your passport. Well, why not, right? Because all the functions of a passport can then also be in there. And if it's already your passport, well, why not make it your wallet? If we already at the same time have central bank digital currencies, then it doesn't make sense to have another digital tool. And so then, of course, it's quite rational to link it. And so it will be your everything. It will be your, you know, house key, door opener. It will be your entry into your office building, will be your passport to cross borders, and it will be your wallet, all in one. And that's, unfortunately, while it's rational and will be quite efficient in a sort of technological sense, it has very severe implications for privacy, for our freedom of, you know, movement, for our freedoms in general, for human rights. It has severe negative consequences, and it's certainly something that we should be extremely cautious about.
I do want to talk about some solutions. So why don't we touch on your work establishing and supporting community banks? Is that an alternative to the proposed paradigm of central bank digital currencies?
I think it is. And I think it's a solution in many respects. What we're witnessing is, you know, ever greater concentration of decision-making power as systems get more centralized and concentrated. And that is efficient in theory, but it neglects human nature. And human nature being what it is, there's a whole string of downsides of ever greater concentration of decision-making power in ever fewer hands. So this concentration trend has huge costs, which somehow don't seem to get considered sufficiently. The solution is to move in the opposite direction, decentralization. So what we need is, and of course, at the core of all this is the monetary system, because without money, nothing happens in the economy and big parts of society. So we need to decentralize. And the best way to decentralize is to, and also the best way to make institutions accountable, because a disadvantage of this big centralized institution is to become totally unaccountable, because they're so centralized and so powerful, nobody can actually check what they're doing. It's just there's too much happening there. They're too big. And that's the reality. We've seen this in so many aspects and industries and so on. The solution is to decentralize and have many, many small institutions which are closely linked into the local economy and are accountable to local stakeholders. And that that works, because then there's true accountability, the small scale. Local people will know what they're doing, and this local community bank, they can't come up with crazy projects that later it turns out are disastrous. It's impossible, because you are part of the community. And therefore, there's accountability, there's better decision making when you have better accountability. But also, it actually supports economic growth and job creation. And there's empirical evidence that if you compare two systems, one is a system where there's only one bank, central bank, let's say, so super highly concentrated monetary system, and compare the performance of that with an economy where you've got thousands and thousands of small local banks, which are the money creators, and they do their job of kicking the tires of tens of thousands of small firms, and they're selecting, and there's interaction, there's also mutual trust and also a sense of responsibility, because it's not transaction banking, this is relationship banking. They know each other, the parties know each other, they feel responsible. People just behave more humane and more accountable and more responsible as a result, and they see the effect of their activities on others. Therefore, we automatically have stakeholder capitalism, where people want to be careful about what they do, because the effect is immediate and everyone can see how they're affecting people. So if you compare these two systems, a centralized one with, say, one bank, Gosbank, like in the Soviet Union, and a decentralized one with thousands of small local community banks being the core of these local economies. Now, guess what? Which one is better in terms of economic performance? Which one is better in terms of stability? You get fewer crises and disasters. Which one is better in terms of job creation? Which one is better in terms of equality versus, you know, very unequal system? And you can go on. Which one is better in terms of having lower inflation? It's so obvious that the decentralized system consisting of many small community banks is far superior to a centralized system. And there's many case studies and you know, empirical evidence in history. Let's just look at China. Because China was originally not really performing that well when it was a Soviet-style economy. And then after Mao, Chairman Mao died, and there's this various you know, upheavals, then Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1978. He looked around and he decided, well, do we want to follow the Soviet path further, where there's one bank and it's all very concentrated? And he concluded it's not really performing well enough. But he looked at some other countries, namely Japan, eastern neighbor of China, having thousands of local community banks, and Germany, which, you know, in China and also in Japan, traditionally Educated leaders have always studied very carefully and have a fairly positive view and attitude to, so that they would be aware of the history. And they found that, oh, actually it's supporting the economy. This decentralized system is performing marvelously well. And then, of course, everyone, as we know, looks at the U.S. economy. Now, if you look at the U.S. economy through the official narrative, you wouldn't see any of that. Banks are just financial intermediaries and so on. But when you are in China and you're studying the U.S. economy, you look at the basic facts. And the basic facts are the U.S. economy has the largest number of banks in the world. And that is a reason for its tremendous economic performance. Now, the proof of this pudding is when Deng Xiaoping then said, okay, let's get rid of the Gosbank, one bank, monobank, Soviet-style system, and let's introduce what seems to be the successful way to go, namely what Japan has done, what Germany has done, what the US has done. And also, if you go back in history, when Britain was successful and had high economic growth, it also had thousands of banks. So Deng Xiaoping then created thousands of banks. He set up local banks, community banks, credit unions, regional banks, specialized lenders. Phenomenal. In a very short time period, thousands of banks were created. And of course, the rest is history. China then delivered four decades of double-digit economic growth, lifting more people out of poverty than anywhere and any time in history before. It's been phenomenally successful, and it would not have happened had they not created so many small local banks. And so it seems quite clear, the empirical record, that a decentralized system where you've got many community banks is superior. And it also has other advantages, you know, because local communities are then much more resilient when there are shocks. And we are talking about crises, whether it's from viruses or other shocks. Well, there's a further justification. If we have a risk of various shocks happening, whatever they may be, whether climate or weather or whatever, that's just another reason, or cyber attacks, that's just another reason why we should have a decentralized system consisting of many, many small local units, and at the core will always be community banks, local banks, because they do create money when they lend, which injects money into these local economies. But they're also the nodes of these local economies that can then handle shocks much, much better than if we have a centralized system. We had recently this attack, some cyber attack on a Florida software company, which then affected a whole bunch of companies in the world. For example, in Sweden, 800 shops were affected. Grocery shops were, you know, supermarkets were affected and had to shut down for several days. People didn't get food from these shops, and their food supplies went bad. Well, this is because of centralization. You know, their system is very centralized in Sweden, and then you just attack one point and you shut down, you know, 800 shops in one go. These are all the risks and costs of centralization. So especially in this time of day, it should be obvious to everyone that the solution is to go in the other direction and have decentralized systems. And also they mean that they're much more small scale, which means they're more human scale. There was an economist called, I think, Schumacher. He wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. And there is this dimension that whenever any institution gets too large, it becomes essentially unhuman. And while it's small, people talk and they, you know, have face-to-face contact, and there is natural accountability. You know, most people are decent people, and that's when society functions best. But once you get institutions that get bigger and bigger, too big, that's when all the problems occur and things become sociopathic and pathological, as the motive just to extract profits and squeeze everyone starts to dominate. People forget that this is all about humans. Well, if you keep things on a small scale, it's almost natural. You don't have to tell anyone to do anything, because that's how we will behave in a much more humane way.
Excellent. Makes perfect sense. Now, lastly, I do want to ask you, how can people support you and your work?
Thank you very much for asking that. Well, I set up a company called Local First Community Interest Company. So it's a social enterprise, and its purpose is to establish community banks and support the creation of thriving local communities and this decentralized economy I've been talking about in many countries. And this company, you know, if you want to support Local First, it will be very welcome, you know, to you know, receive support in any way, financial way, or also in manpower way. And you can also contribute ideas and your interest, but you can also join the movement by letting us know where you are and that you want a local new community bank established, and maybe speak to your local local authorities and local stakeholders to try to get people, you know, band together and get in touch with us. Local First will then help make that real and set up a new community bank in your area.
Excellent. Professor Richard Werner, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. This has been a remarkable and very informative discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time and for these very good questions.
Of course. And I want to thank you all for watching this interview. If you are interested in learning more about Professor Werner's initiative to set up and support community banks, as well as learn more about macroeconomics and how the central banks operate, you can visit his website, professorwerner.org. Please make sure to share this interview on your social media, and don't forget to subscribe to The Last American Vagabond. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and I'll see you guys next time.